He is pressing ahead with vigorous plans to interfere with the elections in Nicaragua. That's exactly what's happening now when these Contras are going back across the border in uniform with their weapons to disrupt the elections in Nicaragua today. He has already interfered with the elections in Panama. As you recall, the Congress allocated $10 million for the purpose of disrupting those elections. He encouraged a disastrous coup d'etat in Panama that blew up, I must say, in his own face. He's delivering arms through Thailand into Kampuchea, destabilizing that country that hasn't had a moment's peace for 25 years. And he's continuing to deliver arms to Jonas Savimbi in Angola, including Stinger missiles, ground-to-air missiles, after Savimbi has boasted openly of shooting down passenger planes. And he's continued military support for the death squads in El Salvador. And under the guise of the drug war, he's putting U.S. military into Latin America, where they're doing the same thing in countries like they've been doing in El Salvador, flying planes, strafing, and rocketing villages. Meanwhile, despite glasnost, the Soviet record is not all that much better. They're continuing to pump arms into Afghanistan and Kampuchea. They're increasing expenditures on their military. In fact, glasnost was not intended to benefit the Third World. The impetus behind glasnost was Soviet economic problems, not sympathy for the Third World. If you go back and read Andrei Kozyrov's article in the New York Times on January 7 of 1989, you find he's calling for the Soviet Union to join with the United States in the capitalist solution in supporting the status quo and what they call stability in countries of the world in the interest of world trade, in which the Soviet Union would become more active. And we find the most shocking thing of all to date is that today Soviet attack helicopters designed for the fighting in Afghanistan are now being used in joint operations with U.S. military and Peruvian military in Peru to strafe and rocket villagers there. Meanwhile, you've got to be screaming, why? What is the purpose of all this? And I promised you I'd bring it all together and show you how these things interrelate. And in a very few minutes, I propose to do that so we can get on to the question and answer period, which is really the most fun part, where you can direct, you know, your interest in these things. Why would we spend billions of dollars to destabilize every corner of the globe for 4 or 5 decades? Economics. I mean, it's a complex world. There are lots of reasons. There are people who do these things just because they think they're fun, to blow things up and kill people. But economics, the biggest stuff. $150 billion drug trade speaks for itself. The second most profitable industry in the world, of course, is the production of arms. $3 billion a day bought and sold of weapons. The defense corporations making 20 to 24% profit. We just got through spending a total of $2.2 trillion on the largest arms buildup perhaps in the history of the world, certainly of any peacetime arms buildup. And our debt increasing by just about exactly the same amount during that period of time. The result is that we've created a society that's dominated by what President Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex. The U.S. taxpayer is now carrying a gigantic burden. One-third of our budget, about, is for the military. 53 cents, according to the Washington Post, of every tax dollar goes to the military. We begin the conditioning to war in this country, this permanent war complex we maintain, pretending we're good guys, at the age of 2. This is the age at which we put our children in front of the one-eyed babysitter and turn it on so we can go wash the dishes or take a break. And they watch the same show with different characters 10 or 15 times a day. And I'm talking about, I have a kid, so I'm into these things. You know, He-Man and Sheena and Scooby-Doo even, and the Transformers and the Decepticons, and what each one of these nice little people put upon by ugly evil forces, always saying, please be nice. The evil forces insist on attacking, and at the last minute, the good guys rise up and stomp them down. Cut, commercial, and we move on, you know, to the next show. Until it's estimated when we graduate from high school, we spent more time watching violence on television than we've spent in the classrooms itself. And then you get into the movies we've been feeding ourselves during this military buildup during the 80s. Rambo, Commando, Red Dawn, the Rocky series, Under Siege, Delta Force, America, Missing in Action, Top Gun, Heartbreak Ridge, Death Before Dishonor, Platoon, Hamburger Hill, Tour of Duty, China Beach, and they go on and on. How many people saw the movie Red Dawn, by the way? This is fun. Don't be embarrassed. It's a great movie. Now, this story, it's science fiction. The producer of this movie went on television around the nation saying it was his purpose to create a movie that would make people, that would draw people back to war, that would make them feel war could be a good and exciting thing. And this film was actually shown in Marine boot camps to motivate people and to National Guard groups that were about to go down to train in Honduras for the possible invasion of Nicaragua. The science fiction is that they have a force, as you recall, of Russians, Cubans, and Nicaraguans who've invaded the United States, and they've gotten all the way to the Rocky Mountains. Now, you ask yourself why, the planning as they did the movie, why did they pick Russians, Cubans, and Nicaraguans? I mean, it would be a better movie if they picked Russians, Canadians, and Cubans. See, because Canada is an industrial country and there's a huge border and there could be the Russians coming across at 100 places and pinning us against Cuba. I mean, you could kind of get your head in. I mean, it's all science fiction. You know, blow off our nuclear weapons and our army and all of that. This is the given. So why did they pick Nicaragua instead of, say, Canada? And the answer is, of course, they were targeting Nicaragua for a possible invasion by U.S. troops. So they had to condition the people that Nicaragua would be the next enemy, the next target. Anyway, this force gets all the way to the Rocky Mountains where they're eventually stopped by the high school football team. Now, I submit to you that the 80s, you see, is the decade of the middle-aged women. This is, you know, Dallas and Dynasty and the Golden Girls and Murder, She Wrote. Linda Evans, you know, is in better physical condition than I am, and Joan Collins is older than I am, and she's a sex symbol, and the Nautilus workouts and the jogging. I mean, an 80s movie would have been the Soviets, Cubans, and Nicaraguans with middle-aged school teachers running through the mountains and shooting them down and drinking deer's blood and all of that. So why did they pick the high school football team? You see, the answer is obvious. They're going to fight the next war with the 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds. It's not going to be the middle-aged 50-year-olds. We're too smart. We've seen the cynicism of war. We wouldn't buy it. It's at that age, the high school graduates, where the young men are suffering from their massive doses of testosterone poisoning. And their minds have not yet had a chance to be filled, for all of them, some are precautious, but many of them have not yet had a chance to fill their minds with experience to understand what the world is all about, to understand how they're being used. So that's why they targeted that film at the high school. And then you look at the ads on television that were pumping at us then and now. Join the army, be all that you can be with these tanks jumping ditches and helicopters going 200 miles an hour. And these things are great. I watched them and come up on the edge of my chair. And we didn't have tanks like that when David and I were in the Marine Corps. They would jump a little ditch and break down. And they were not computerized. And they didn't go in. The helicopters went about 80 miles an hour and not 200 miles an hour. And so, you know, then I say, wait a minute, what's going on here? What's missing, you know? Where are the young men with their legs blown off at the knees, with their intestines wrapped around their necks? And the answer is that these things are not meant to educate. See, that's where they're reaching inside people's breasts and pressing buttons and manipulating people to join the army and be all that you can be and be available to be sent down to Central America to kill people and to die for your country. And then there's the most insidious ad I think I've seen in all of the days that I've watched television. This is the one of the soldier coming home on vacation in uniform, handsome young man. He's met by his brother. I think he's getting off a train. And he says, Dad never did understand why I joined the Army. And then they're driving and he says, do you think you'll ever forgive me? And the boy says, well, you know Dad. And then they get in the living room and the young soldier says, Dad. And the father turns and hugs him and all is forgiven. Well, what's the point? They must have spent hundreds of millions of dollars on this ad. What's the point? The point, you see, is that there are a lot of fathers in this country that are saying, do not join the Army. They've seen the Vietnam War and the Korean War, and they've seen the cynicism, and they're telling their sons not to join the Army. And this ad is saying that it's okay, according to the values of U.S. society, to defy your father and join the Army. Now, the result, of course, of this runaway arms race that we've got going with this expenditure, giant expenditures on the military, is that we can't afford it. We're having to cut every conceivable social service. We can't afford to care for the old people or the poor people or the handicapped people or the farmers or to help the young people get through college. And we're gutting Social Security to cover the deficit. I repeat, you and I, if you've got a job, we're taxed, the FICA tax. It's 15%. Your employer pays 7.5%. If you're self-employed like me, you pay all 15%. And this is your retirement. You're supposed to get that back when you're 65. And they're spending that money like it was windfall profits to cover the deficit that they've run up on the production of arms. The real deficits are running about $300 billion. They're calling them $152 billion. The difference they're claiming against borrowing against the Social Security Retirement Fund that belongs to us. And they're spending it on their military today. What's happening is that the United States has plunged relative to the rest of the world. 25% of the people in this country are now functionally illiterate. We're sixth in the world in terms of the percentage of children in school. We're 10th in the world in quality of education. We're 7th in the world in terms of life expectancy. We're 20th in the world in terms of infant mortality. To sell these sacrifices to the American people, the world has to be hostile and dangerous. If the world were peaceful, we would never put up with this kind of expenditure on arms. These thousands of CI destabilizations have the function of killing people who never were our enemies, but the effect of leaving behind for each one of them perhaps five loved ones who are now traumatically conditioned to violence to ensure that the world will go on being violent. And in each one of them, leaving behind the Contras and the Cuban exiles and the people in Southeast Asia and elsewhere that we trained into this brutality to guarantee that the world will go on being brutal to justify this giant arms scam and keep it going. Meanwhile, even if the morality of all this and the damage to our nation doesn't bother you, we got to take a serious look at this. The arms race is breaking the economies of both of the superpowers. The multinational defense corporations have no great loyalty to the United States. They are no longer U.S. corporations. They make enormous profits and invest the money overseas. They are quite willing to sell the U.S. economy down the drain in order to make their profits. While the United States is producing MX missiles, which you put in the ground, which can never be used, and most significantly, they can never be traded. Countries overseas, our allies, not our enemies, are producing Sonys and Toyotas and passing us by in the trade deficits, and we're plunging deep into debt. To take a beautiful and clear, simple example, President Reagan spent more money on his more presidential energy on his Contra program against Nicaragua than any other aspect of the presidency. He spent more time talking publicly about his Contras than any other aspect of the presidency. His Contra program in Nicaragua, a country with two elevators, while Japan was proceeding to capture 30% of the international overseas exchange, and the United States became a debtor nation for the first time since World War I with the greatest debt in the history of the world. The second reason that we've got to take a long, hard look at this system of doing business is because the result of a runaway arms race is the production of arms. We've saturated with the world, booby-trapped it, as Carl Sagan says, with 60,000 thermonuclear weapons. In 1981, we had the capability of destroying utterly 80 Soviet unions, of rendering 20 planets uninhabitable. Now, despite the INF treaty, the world is four times as dangerous as it was in 1981. The U.S. and the USSR have effected a 40% increase in the numbers of their strategic weapons, and they've made them more modern and more efficient. The U.S. is currently racing to deploy the B-1B bomber, the B-2 bomber, the MX missile, the Trident-2 missiles, and the Star Wars programs. Meanwhile, the Soviet Union is deploying 3,300 more accurate, more sophisticated strategic weapons that can target any corner of the United States. And the Soviet Union now, the makers of the Chernobyl plant, are marketing a nuclear reactor for use in space. Any country wants to buy one, they'll sell them one. And there are nine other countries rushing to join the nuclear club. And they tell us these things are fail-safe. We don't have to worry about them. And even if you don't have time to read the books or the scientific articles or even the newspapers, if you've only read the headlines, you know that none of this stuff is fail-safe. Backing up a couple of years, in one 12-month period of time, the Challenger 2 blew up, a Delta rocket blew up, two Titan missiles blew up, a French Ariane missile blew up, a Chernobyl plant melted down, and a Soviet SS-18 blew up, and that was not a particularly bad year. We've dropped 7 bombs accidentally out of airplanes. I won't take the time to list them all, but the one over South Carolina we never found. And so they went in and bought a huge tract of the swampland and declared it a nuclear restricted zone. And that bomb presumably is still there in that brackish water rusting, unless, of course, someone else has found it. 6 submarines have sunk into the bottom of the ocean. We recovered 2. One of ours, one of theirs, at least 4 submarines down, twisted and rusting in the bottom of the ocean with their nuclear plants and nuclear weapons on board. The IPS reported last spring that there is debris from 50 nuclear reactors and nuclear weapons scattering the bottom of the ocean today. And we have hundreds of millions of gallons of radioactive waste that we have no idea what to do with that will still be toxic 50,000 years from now, and huge stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons. And proceeding apace, integral into all of this, I haven't had the time to show the relationship, but I will if you want to ask in the question and answer, is the systematic destruction of our environment. Carl Sagan says, a species divided against itself cannot survive. A planet divided against itself cannot survive. Eisenhower, as he was leaving office in a speech, said, the people of the world genuinely want peace. Someday the leaders of the world are going to have to give in and give it to them. Helen Caldicott, talking around the nation on this issue with some passion, says, get involved. Your planet is at stake. It's terminally ill with this public health disease, which is the arms race. If we don't clean it up, the planet will die. And she notes, if you will get to work on it, you'll feel better about yourself and your planet and your environment and your life. And she notes very dramatically that if you do get involved in working on this problem, if the missiles start going off someday and there's a few minutes before the one lands on your town, at least you can turn to your loved one and hug them and say, honey, at least we tried. Now, if I stopped this right now, I would be doing you a great service because, you know, it is such an awesome down subject, terrifying and disempowering. And yet people have done dramatic things over history to change the way people interrelated with each other. Glasnost is a tentative, in some ways misguided, but nevertheless a step in the direction of people stopping this madness, stopping the arms race. That should give us hope. I'll just give you 2 quick examples, and then we'll go to the question and answer. One, these are carefully chosen. I've done a lot of reading on the subject of hope as well. One of these is the women's movement in this country. 80 years ago, a man could put his sister's wife, daughters to work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week in factories and pocket their salaries. And if they didn't like it, he could beat them, and there was nothing they could do about it. And that has changed to the evolving situation of women today, not by accident, but by the determined struggles of feminist activists. And the reason I select this example is they did it without cracking skulls. They did it without killing people. They did it without violence. My point is that if the problem is essentially testosterone poisoning, as Carl Sagan calls it, we're not going to solve the problem with more testosterone poisoning or more violence. We have to find, on an evolutionary scale, a new way for human beings to interrelate with each other, or we're going to self-destruct as a species. And the other example, we're all disempowered. We're all so helpless. The individual here in Washington or in Maine, where I was a couple of nights ago, or in South Texas or California, what can I do? And it's a tough one. We're up against the power structure. We're up against the military-industrial complexes with the media bought and woven right into the things. And it's a tough one. But the professor who stopped the war is a wonderful, to me, inspiring example. My war in Angola. Then young professor Jerry Bender of UC San Diego, who had done his studies in Angola, and he saw what we were doing, and they bothered him. And he couldn't figure out what to do about it. How could he stop it? So one day he picked up the telephone, and he called his senator. And he said, Senator Tunney, I have an expertise on Angola. I see what the CIA is doing. I think they're lying to you. I think it's dangerous. I would like the opportunity to brief you. I will not waste your time. And the senator listened to him and came back to Washington and found that we were indeed lying to the Congress. And he introduced the Tunney Amendment to the FY76 Defense Appropriation Act that stopped my war in Angola. Now, some years ago, I came to talk to Admiral LaRocque at the Center for Defense Information here in Washington because I was way over my head to ask him, you know, people ask me, Admiral, I said, what can I do? And I don't know what to tell him specifically. And this beautiful old man, we were having breakfast at his home, and he stood up. He said, I love that question. He said, I tell people, I don't know you, but you know yourselves. You know what your capabilities are. He said, I tell people, if you can write, write articles, write letters, write books, write telegrams. If you can organize, organize. If you can travel, go to Nicaragua or the Las Vegas test sites and see for yourself so you can be an intelligent witness to what's happening in the world. He said, and I quote, I tell people, if they feel comfortable lying down in front of bombs, trucks with bombs on them, to lie down in front of trucks with bombs on them. But he said, I tell them, you've got to do what you can do every day of your life. You can't wait until you graduate next summer or get married or get divorced or get a job, because these things malfunction all the time, and they're controlled by intellectual giants like Ronald Reagan. And the world may not be here by the time you graduate next summer or get divorced or get a job or whatever. Thank you very much for hearing me out. Thank you. Yes?
Just a question. How did you come to see the light? And if you could just tell us briefly.
Yeah.
In terms of...
I can tell you very briefly. I can also tell you that this is a subject of another lecture that I give, which we call Getting In and Getting Out, a Career in the CIA, with anecdotes of how they recruit you and how they train you, and the experiences that turn your mind around, or did mine. And in the briefest possible terms, people like myself, I know, of course, myself quite well, David, I know pretty well, we're not people that change easily. By the way, David, why don't you stand up? They should know who you are. David is an organizer in here in Washington who was in the Second Force Recon Company that I was in. He was a year or two ahead of me. We're not people that change easily. And we were conditioned by childhood experiences to believe that these were noble and right things to do, defending our country from the evils of this, that, and the other. I had to get into the CIA. All that conditioning in the Marine Corps, all that conditioning in the CIA. I had to get into, at the lower levels in the CIA, they keep the conditioning going. The cover stories. You don't talk punk talk, you don't talk goon talk. You don't send a cable to headquarters saying, send me out an assassin to knock off somebody. If you did, you would get put down. You'd get reprimanded. It's all very high-minded. There is some doublespeak. And at a certain level, operations are killing people, certainly. But especially for the younger officers, they keep the myths going. I began to get a little higher. I never made it all the way to the top by any manner of means, but I did get into the management of three operations. I did get to be a chief of station where I was dealing with policy. I did get into a position in the Vietnam War in a key province where I saw the utter horror and debacle and shamefulness of the CIA's evacuation from Vietnam. And I'll let that be a separate question. If someone asks that, I'll tell you about the evacuation from Vietnam and how the CIA chief of station was delivering our secrets to the enemy and what happened to him after that. And then I came back to the States and was put in charge of the Angola Task Force, a big break for someone at the level of a GS-14. Just like Ollie North, who was Lieutenant Colonel, I was about the same grade with a similar background, except I had professional training, and I hope my gyroscope was bolted down solidly. His is missing a couple of key bolts down on the base, obviously, and wobbles a little bit. But nevertheless, I found myself in a position where I was literally occupying the responsibilities of someone much older. A GS-17 would normally have had that job. Because the chief of Africa Division had been struck down with polio and was somewhat immobile, he wanted to run this operation, but he literally needed, he had no paramilitary expertise, which I did, and he needed a good set of legs. And I was very young and energetic and jogging and lifting weights, and so we were kind of a team. And that put me on a subcommittee of the National Security Council running this operation internationally. Now, you can ask, in Vietnam, we left our employees behind in a scandalous way, and in many cases, we left the files behind that identified them. And this is something that no Marine officer could ever do and look himself in the mirror when he shaves anymore the rest of his life. And we did it. I fought it, but I was forced to do it and left the country, leaving my people behind. So you can ask, you know, well, why did you take this next job? And without being melodramatic, I am not a brilliant person, and I was much more confused then. So there was no brilliance in my decision, but quite literally I went out and sat on a rock in Great Falls Park out here and muddled about what should I do. And the one thing I just could not get out of my mind is after all these years in the field running operations that did not make sense in terms of national security, in terms of the benefits to the United States that were hurting people, it seemed needlessly, I was being offered a job in the inner sanctum. Where I would have access to every document that was written about the Angolan program and its rationales, every one copy, eyes only to the president, memo, note, letter, I would have access to, be part of. And I just couldn't resist it. If you want to dramatize it, you could say I made a deal with the devil. I felt like I was joining something that would be evil and criminal, but I could not resist being inside. And then once I got inside, I had to see it through to the end. And I worked extremely hard. These jobs, this is something that North does not exaggerate when he was writing notes saying, someday I've got to get some sleep. You close your safes well after midnight, and you're sitting back at your desk at 6 in the morning, and that goes on holidays, weekends, around the clock, Christmas, on in a fly overseas, fly back. You don't have time to go home to change clothes. You're working so hard to keep all of the things going because it's happening in Angola, but you're coordinating them all over the world. And I didn't want to stop until it was over because I didn't want to feel like I had seen up to here and I hadn't seen the end of the show. And I was taking notes as I went. You're permitted to do that in the agency because you're having meetings, a staff meeting, for example, from which may come 50 immediate cables, all of them vitally important. And you've got to be able to put down 7,000 rifles and not 700,000 rifles. So. A lot of people are scribbling notes, and I carefully scribbled notes, including as rapidly verbatim as I could, as what Kissinger said, what Ambassador Admiral Cahey said, what Jim Potts, Bill Colby said, what each person said. Sometimes I couldn't keep up with them, but trying to get it all down because I had a purpose not to write a book. It never entered my mind. I had never known anyone who had written a book at that time, but I just wanted to know for myself what this stuff was all about. Just to give you one anecdote. And again, you can read my book, In Search of Enemies, so we don't have to spend more time on the Angola program, except just to say that National Security Council meetings, and I didn't get to go to many of those. The CIA director would go to those. I went to all of the working group subcommittee meetings. But the National Security Council meetings are, they're important men. And I say men because I don't know of any women that have ever served on them. Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, Vice President, the President comes in sometimes, a CIA director. People like that with enormous responsibilities and power who are aware of their power. The etiquette is that you don't keep people waiting. You don't show up 30 minutes late to those meetings because the other people are powerful and busy too. Henry Kissinger came to the meeting late, and everyone was having to wait. Now, mind you, this is not a meeting of the Supreme Court, which is prescribed by law where everybody sits according to seniority. At least that time, it was an office, a not very esoteric office, in the White House with an oak table and some drapes and some maps, but no electronic flashing boards or anything like that, and people sit around a table, and then chairs where staffers can sit around beside the table and help the boss. And the Secretary of Defense plopped down in a chair to talk to somebody while we waited for Kissinger. And then Kissinger came steaming in, and he told the Secretary of Defense, you know, I'm here, we can go to work, move down to your chair. And the Secretary of Defense said, well, I'm all set up here today, you sit down there today. And Kissinger said, no, I'm the Secretary of State, this is my chair, you sit down there. And they argued like five-year-olds for about 5 minutes, and eventually the Secretary of Defense wouldn't move, and Kissinger had to go sit down at that end of the table, but he turned his back on the briefings and sulked. He wouldn't pay attention to that, to what we were saying that day, because he couldn't have his chair. And we were making decisions that were getting people killed in Angola, and I'm not exaggerating one bit. I could go on and on with such anecdotes of what I saw. Some of them obviously much more pertinent and detailed and serious than that one, but the fact that I left afterwards, I testified for 5 days to the Congress. I did not plead the Fifth Amendment. I did not think that officers in the Marine Corps and middle-level officers in the CIA should have the right to plead the Fifth Amendment. If they've been involved in a government operation, doing what they thought was their duty, if they've gone awry, I felt like we had a responsibility to take our medicine if punishment was due. In addition to which, because of the nature and detail of my notes, I knew there was no way they could put me in jail without putting Henry Kissinger in jail and the CIA Director Bill Colby in jail too. So that would be my consolation if they convicted us of a conspiracy in the thing. And that's the beginning of the story, because I left the agency then, I wrote the book, and then I went on to read endlessly and travel to countries like Grenada and Nicaragua and Cuba and Vietnam, target countries, to try to learn for myself what this stuff was all about that I had been part of. Yes, sir.
Could you please comment on Barbara Honegger's well-substantiated allegations of treason against Ronald Reagan and George Bush related to the CIA's murder of American military men in the October 1979 sabotage rescue mission in the Iranian desert in a bid to ensure Carter's defeat?
Just a second. I'm going to get to that, and that's a good question. But we have Lou. Are you still here? Yeah, Lou is the editor of the Covert Action Information Bulletin, which has probably done more to bring the history of the covert action, of the secret activities of this government public than any other one writer or author or publisher in the nation. And he's got copies back there, and I highly recommend his research and work too. Now, excuse me, sir, getting back to your question. With the October surprise, well, this is an awkward question because I cannot endorse Barbara Honegger's research because I found it to be sloppy in some cases. So I'm not going to comment on it in detail. I will comment on the October surprise by saying that most of the best heads that I know analyzing that event, what the event is that in 1980, our embassy was being held hostage, and our media was making a big issue out of it as part of the surge towards conservatism that eventually got Ronald Reagan and George Bush elected into the presidency. And this was a massive orchestrated plan that involved the ABC television with America held hostage on television several times a day to keep the people exercised and feeling militant, with people in the Pentagon and the CIA and the State Department cooperating with the Bush-Reagan candidates to Jimmy Carter's detriment. The point was that in October, if the hostages had been released, it's quite possible that Jimmy Carter would have won the election. So it was urgently important that Iran not release the hostages until after the elections, and they did not. And then they held them another 76 days until the inauguration of Ronald Reagan and released them 2 hours after he was sworn into office so he would get credit for their release. And within a few weeks, the first flow of arms was approved, sale of arms to Iran. Secret sale of arms was, in fact, approved. So the best heads that I know believe, seem to agree that there was a tacit agreement, at least, between the Bush-Reagan campaign and the Iranian government, that if they would keep the embassy people hostage, that the U.S. administration, the Reagan administration, would smile on them afterwards. Now, as far as the details of the story that George Bush flew to Paris to deliver $40 million to the Iranians as a payment for that sort of thing, in my own experience following this as closely as I can and talking to lots of journalists who have conscientiously researched this, I have not found that the case has been made to the point where I would have published it had I been a journalist or editor of the Washington Post. There are gaps. There's just details that are not there that would have been there, I think, if the story were completely true. Moreover, one of the very astute people I know, Cy Hirsch, maybe one of the best investigative journalists of our time, I would say one of the very best, certainly, maybe the best, he says The Iranians were quite smart enough to know in their own interests. They didn't have to be told by George Bush that it would work in their interests and favor to keep the embassy hostage and let Reagan get credit for their release. If they released the hostages after having antagonized and humiliated Carter, he would come after them with a vengeance. If they cooperated as they did with Reagan by keeping the embassy people hostage and giving Reagan credit for getting them out, Reagan would tend to go soft on them, which he did, and Khomeini could brag to his people that he had in fact impacted the American elections and virtually picked who our next president would be and ensured that it was his choice of Satan's in office, if you will. So perhaps that will suffice as a comment on that, and I again will not address Barbara Honegger's writing in detail. Yes, sir.
Getting back to what you said about Noriega maybe having the goods on Bush, combined with other incidents like Station Chief Buckley being having all that information extracted from him, and if indeed the presidency is being held hostage, or certainly we're experiencing a paralysis, yet denying degradation to the environment like lemmings, given also the dynamic with the East and their rapid changes, and it's becoming more of a north-south rather than east-west situation, so much of the CIA work is analyzing. Could you give us perhaps a look at the global situation, and as the spiral tightens, what's going on and what we can expect in the Bush administration, for example?
This is getting into the questions that you love, in fact, because this gentleman has obviously got his finger on the pulse of what's happening in the world and is studying it in a serious way. And a lot of lectures I give are to people who know where Washington is and are interested in CIC stories. The Soviet Union, to me, we're in obviously the most dangerous, dynamic, exciting, troublesome period of change that I've seen since I was a kid at the end of World War II. The Soviet leadership has recognized that the arms race has been a real bummer for the Soviet economy. They came out of World War II with a giant complex about having been invaded once again by European powers, and they said never again, at any price. And with an enormous price of sacrifice of consumer goods and comforts for the Soviet people, they created a superpower military. So you have a country there now which in some ways is a third world country, but with a superpower military and nuclear weapons and all of that. Now, the country is falling further and further behind not only Europe and the United States, but also the Pacific Rim countries. Singapore, Taiwan, for example, South Korea, not to mention Japan, passing the Soviet Union by in terms of effective, productive industrial countries. And to turn this around, they simply have to get out from under this gigantic burden of producing arms so that the people have enough of an interest. I mean, large portions of the Soviet Union don't have electricity. They don't have adequate housing. They don't have washing machines. They suffer privations that we would not enjoy. They spend a lot of time, instead of working in the factory, scurrying around at other jobs, just trying to have it a little better. And there's an entire industry that's defeating the purposes of the major industries. And the leadership eventually recognized this, and that's what Gorbachev is all about. The trouble is that the Soviet Union also, and Lord knows the moves they've made and the crow that they've eaten, they've admitted they lost the Cold War. They've admitted that communism, well, in varying ways, that communism, they let Hungary say it's not a communist country. Things are happening in East Germany and Czechoslovakia that are utterly astonishing in terms of what you would have expected 3 or 4 years ago. And railing openly against themselves, against their own non-productivity, against what they have to do to turn their situation around. The trouble is that the Soviet Union has its full and fair share of Jesse Helms and Oliver North. And people, and Pat Buchanan's, for heaven's sake, and people who would stomp the world, who want a military machine. And the word seems to be that if Gorbachev cannot show economic results in the relative near future, either he will be ousted by a conservative backlash, or he will have to turn hard-nosed and crack down himself. It seems to be very much with, now the map is being reconstructed, whatever happens, but it seems to be very possible that in the next few years, and the Soviet economic problems are not problems that you can change in 2 years' time. 20 years, 50 years, yes. But I don't think Gorbachev can make the requisite changes in the time allotted, and the clock's running on him. So we're going to see major dramatic upheavals and changes, and quite possibly a major crackdown. We've seen a major crackdown in China, for example, which was moving towards glasnost, and the people got a taste of it and clomp back to a repression like in the mid and late 50s. We could see this in the Soviet Union with the return to the Cold War. There are certainly plenty of people in the United States, including both intellectuals who analyze it that way, Sovietologists, but also people in the military-industrial complex who would benefit enormously if it went that route, who are quite wishfully hoping it will, quite obviously wishfully wishing that it will. And I can't predict what's going to happen, except I'm sitting here aware, keenly aware, reading the papers with a sense that we're living the most exciting and perhaps most dangerous period of history that I've witnessed in my 52 years.
But our economy and our perceived arrogance in light of all this, of our, you know, seemingly not wanting to face reality here, and as you so eloquently outlined, our real dangerous situation that we stand with just on an economic level alone. Can you look a little into that?
It seems to me, and I consult with economists every chance I get, like Lloyd Dumas down in Texas and others, about just that. Where's it going for us? And mind you, all economists, like Talmudic scholars, disagree, it seems, about whether, you know, slow decline of the United States or sudden collapse or what's going to happen. It seems to me that one possibility of what is going to evolve, it's clear that we have lost economic superpower status. We still are a gigantic driving economic machine, but we're a debtor machine. Other countries are healthier than we are economically. They're creditor countries, specifically Japan and Germany. Other countries have industrial trade trade gaps, trade credits instead of deficits, including Taiwan, for example, and Korea and Singapore, to our disadvantage, sucking the money away from us. But what they're doing so far is reinvesting the money back, buying up the debts in the United States. It has not turned into a bad debt yet. It's just that we own less and less of ourselves, of our own country, so that we're creating a situation where there will be other peoples who will be the bankers, and we will remain the policemen, or the soldiers, or if you will, the mercenaries, or describe it as you will. The way this could actually work would be, we obviously would have tremendous clout, but we would have less control of economic decisions around the world. Just to give you some examples of how this works, George Bush, I don't know if you caught the 60 Minutes show during the presidential election campaign, in which they revealed that 18 members of his campaign staff had accepted six-figure fees from other governments to advise them. He had surrounded himself with international lobbyists. What they're moving towards is an internationalist world, a multinational world. The people that he represents, which are the capitalists, are internationalists now, and they don't see the U.S. as an island in itself, or their island, or their country. They see a world economy of which they're a part and in control, and the U.S. building missiles, and they can profit from that, and the U.S. standard of living dropping, that's okay with them because their standard of living is certainly not dropping. And then watching, you know, events in Russia and China and other parts of the world to see how they can play and tune them to the increased productivity of their own economic interests. One thing that Lloyd Dumas points out to me, though, that's pretty scary, is I'm saying to him, but look, they spend all this money to build these weapons, and then the weapons could destroy the world, and they're not, it doesn't seem like they're thinking very far ahead in terms of their own interests. And he says, are you kidding? You know, these people are looking at quarterly reports, and if they're in the red for two quarters, they're out. And they're not planning the world economy, they're not planning the economic health of the United States. There's some vague trilateral planning between Europe, the U.S., and Japan of how they can work together to achieve greater industrial success. But basically, they're looking at very short-term profits of their corporations in competition with other corporations, and which is another way of saying they're not responsible. They don't consider it their job to be responsible for the fate of the earth. That's other people's worries. Their job is to get that next quarterly report into the black and the shares up.
First I noted that you seemed not to mention too much about Afghanistan, which, as you mentioned, is the largest covert operation, arguably, since World War II. At the risk of being a bit specific, I wondered if you might comment on what many believe the covert operation, CIA covert operation in Afghanistan, is run by only a handful of men. And how is it that the CIA, if you believe that, if you're familiar with it, how could that come about that the CIA would let that happen, or was it a policy, or did it just come about like that, or could you comment on that?
You're saying that it was run by a handful of CIA men?
Well, that it still is, but that it was much smaller, a much smaller group of men than typically for such a large operation should have been in charge for such a large operation.
Well, this operation, we get glimmers and glimpses of the budget now and then, hundreds of millions of dollars, and we get a sense of its size, which would make it, I mean, at times when Contra program was getting $19 million and then $100 million increments, they were getting hundreds of millions of dollars. So it seemed to be a much larger operation. It was never controversial. The administration never chose to make it a controversial issue, which they chose to make the Contra program a public issue, apparently because they wanted to condition the nation to an eventual invasion of Nicaragua. They did not want to have a public debate about Afghanistan, and it was not a situation where they were as vulnerable because there was a Soviet army there. So it was harder for people in this country to marshal a protest of the CIA going in to help the Afghani people. Now, in fact, there was a lot of cynicism in it that could have been brought out. The Soviet invasion, in fact, was provoked by the CIA trying to engineer a coup d'etat that would have created a government on the Soviet flank that would have been loyal to the CIA, as Iran had been under the Shah, more or less. And the Soviets, not willing to let that happen, put in their troops. So there's that kind of complexity behind the scenes. And then this massive flow of arms and relatively little information about the details of how it was run. I have not commented on it in great length because it was not an area of operations where I ever served when I was with the government, nor is it an area that I visited since I left the government, nor has there been a great mass of information available about it. And therefore, rather than speculate, I've just mentioned it in passing. If they did manage to manage it with fewer people, it would mean that they were setting up pipelines, fewer CI staff people. They were setting up pipelines to funnel the money and the arms to the forces that they were supporting in Afghanistan. And this might or might not be a factor in more of that being used to smuggle drugs to other enterprises and Stinger missiles getting lost and floating around the terrorist community. So we're faced now, there are, 50-odd Stinger missiles that are missing now, that are not accounted for, that might appear in Ireland, for example, or somewhere else. And the people who worry about terrorism are sweating that with good reason. Yes?
I was really interested to hear you explain how the destruction of the environment figured into everything else you were talking about.
Yes. The destruction of the environment, of course, is in some ways there's only the parallel of just the indifference to the fate of the earth. The same mentality that would produce 60,000 thermonuclear weapons and bluff and play with them is the same mentality that's saying, we're not going to be here very long anyway. It's the James Watt syndrome saying the fate of the earth, the end of the earth is in sight. God put these things on earth for us to use them, so we might as well chop down the trees, you know, and D-Day will come when the last tree is felled, when the earth ends anyway. This kind of short-sighted thinking, the presumption, the Jerry Falwell, you know, God will call the chosen up on high and a wishing, you know, begging, please call us kind of thinking, as opposed to seeing ourselves as custodians of the planet Earth. It's taken, as Carl Sagan points out, 4 billion torturous years to evolve to the point where we are today. We, whatever we are we going to pass on something for, you know, that will be here another 1 billion years? Or will it be here another 25 years? And our attitudes are 25 years. We're doing things now that if we move to correct in terms of the greenhouse effect, in terms of the toxic wastes, I mean, they're running studies now. Carl Sagan has sent me some material on this, some papers that he's delivered, and because I'm finishing up a book on the subject of the arms race, showing how they're spending X billions of dollars to study how these toxic materials could be stored safely for 10,000 years, because that's the maximum amount of time that they can possibly estimate the state of the crust of the world's. You know, they can't plan beyond that, but the stuff will be toxic 50,000 or more years. And so, you know, we're not planning that far down the road. But getting more specific beyond just the arrogance, you get into the weapons plants, where managers of the plants have some radioactive gases or liquids that they need to get rid of. And if they go to the Congress and say, we have this problem, we need $10 billion to find a way to store these things, it becomes a big, stinky political issue. So they just quietly open the vents and let them blow out into the atmosphere and dump them into, you know, in Pantex. And this, by the way, the media got onto this finally. We've had it in the peace community for decades. The best book I can think of on the subject is Wasserman and Solomon's book, Killing Our Own. Which is an excellent book summarizing this kind of and details of this kind of activity. But at the Pantex plant in near Amarillo, Texas, they had these hot radioactive liquids, and again, they didn't want to go to Congress and ask for money, so they dug what we call tanks in the ground. That's the farmers dig tanks with bulldozers and to collect rainwater for the cattle to drink. They scraped out these flat tanks in the ground and poured the stuff in there without sealing it, not, I mean, with rubber or concrete or anything. They just poured the stuff in there so it could percolate down into the Oglala Aquifer, or blow, the winds are quite strong, blow into neighboring fields or evaporate up into the air. And that was their donation to the environment, just to save money and embarrassment. Now, there is a move afoot to investigate these things and to talk about cleaning it up, and to talk about criminal charges for the directors of some of these plants. So, you know, we are making dents on some of this. These thousands of books that are out now, the 120 books on my list, are almost all written in the 80s. I should have gone on one more minute in my talk to point out that your effort, some of you, I was on the other side, stopped the Vietnam War eventually. 2 million people had been killed. But if you hadn't risen up and taken to the streets and made them get out, 4 million people would have been killed. And I will flatly assert that we stopped and blocked the invasion of Central America during the 80s. We, all of us, myself, Lou Wolf, David, Allen, all of us, a lot of you, the Reagan administration had clearly committed itself to orchestrating this nation into a war, and they'd picked Nicaragua. And they were blocked by the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, in open debates. He was saying, not with my Defense Department until you can sell it to the American people so they will applaud the troops coming home. No more Vietnams. No more unpopular wars. We will not do it unless you can sell it in advance to the people. And we kept the vigilance of the people up to 66% to 70% against a military intervention. So that Weinberger himself was saying, no, not, and Gorman and Galvin down in the South Command and the Joint Chiefs are saying, no way until the people buy it. If you can get the percentages down to 55% in favor of it, we'll think about it. So we can make a difference, and we are making a difference in terms of the accountability of plant directors, for example, in the munitions and arms plants. Not enough, not fast enough. The problem is much greater. But at the same time, you know, we do have them talking. We did get an INF treaty. We did stop the Central American War. You know, you grab at straws of hope because you need hope in order to keep your energies up.
Yes, I'd like to bring back the issue of Nicaragua and get your response to the interference in Nicaragua's election, the massive infusion of money, and the destabilization of that election. And also, I'd like to get your response, what do you think the scenario would be if the Sandinistas win the next election?
Well, a well-run election manipulation operation you won't see too much of. The CIA will be there quietly giving money to the to its choice candidates, and the candidates will be spending the money and building the cadres, and of course it taints their cause to have the CIA up front. So generally the CIA will not come to the rallies and go to the big meetings. They'll have quiet meetings in the CIA officer's home, and the Violeta Chamorros will walk out with $5 million in cash to distribute and disperse, and the CIA will put in radio stations around the region, of which there are 70 that can beam shows into the targeted country, namely Nicaragua, full of the propaganda. But still, it has to be orchestrated quietly for it to be maximum effectiveness. This is one of the Sandinistas' biggest points now, strengths, is that Chamorro is just very openly identified as the CIA candidate there. There have been elections won by the CIA candidate in 1980, Ciaga, C-I-A-G-A is the way it's spelled, I believe, in Jamaica, won the election despite open support from the CIA. So Chamorro might win if the country were stressed out enough and the people were so tired, and the Sandinistas with their policies had turned sour and turned the people off. I don't think she will. I don't think she'll come close. But if it's done well, we may not see. We do have historical evidence, though, to see how these things are done. In 1984, in El Salvador, the CIA spent $2.2 million on those elections successfully to put Napoleon Duarte, a longtime CIA agent, into power. He was selected because he was a moderate who could be sold to the people in this country as a moderate, so the support could continue to El Salvador. The reason we know so much about that election is because this antagonized Jesse Helms, who favored Roberto Bobbison, you know, Nazi comrades in arms. And so he went public from his position on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He got himself briefed of the truth of what the CIA had done, and he held a press conference and told us in great rage about how much money, how it had been spent. Some of the things I recall, they hired organized teams of journalists from Europe and around and flew them on blue chip tours of El Salvador, guiding them through, taking nice care of them, and paying them off handsomely to go back and write articles that would create international sympathy for Duarte's campaign. They're obviously doing the same thing with Chamorro. In this get-together in Costa Rica, she was clearly presented in the most favorable light by not just Bush, but Arias and all the others. And so that's a little evidence right there of the ploy and what they're doing
now. And that's where we have to finish. If you'd like to hear the rest of that interview, you can go to this show's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/656. There's another half hour or so of questions which we couldn't fit into the show due to time. This and all previous episodes of the show are available for download from the MP3 archive, unwelcomeguests.net/archive, as are our audiobooks. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I hope you found this an enlightening episode. It's unusual we play material from a quarter of a century ago. I shall value your feedback on it.